I'm ready whenever you are.
Oh, we'll put this in the fridge and I'm ready to go.
If you need a minute.
Oh, no, I'm ready.
I am going to silence my phone. All right.
Here.
Cheers, man. I'm in Austin, Texas, with Tommy Robertson of Tommy's Drum Shop.
There you go.
Now, first of all, thank you for having me over, Tommy. Well, we're at the shop. It's after hours, and I appreciate you doing this.
Hey, no problem. No problem.
It's been a long time in the making.
It has. You've been asking me a few months.
I appreciate it.
Sorry about that. But
no,
here we go. Here we go.
I appreciate your patience, man. Now, let's just start from here. So, when did this shop open?
The original store opened officially January 3rd, 1979. And I was located at 12th and Lamar, behind the tavern. It was called Infield Center.
Okay.
Back there. And so I rented the space. It's now where some crystal shop is now, in that location. And I rented it in the fall of 78. And then start doing remodel, getting it fixed up, and all this kind of stuff. And Fishy opened the doors January 3rd, 79.
Now, what made you get into this? How did it all happen?
Well, I've been playing almost all my life. Went through school bands and everything, and was playing gigs and doing all these other things. I worked for two different music stores. Worked for Wright's Music for a while. They used to have a store over on Fort View Drive over here called Wright's Horn and Drum Shop, and worked there for a little while, and then worked some other odd jobs. Ended up working for J.R. Reed Music downtown, and worked there for about a year also. So that's kind of how I cut my teeth and kind of learned a little bit about music stores and how it works and everything else like that. And this is in between gigging and doing all that kind of stuff and everything. And after a while, I just basically really actually had a dream, quite literally, where I just kind of woke up in the middle of the night and just it's kind of like hit me over the head, because I wasn't really into the, I love music, I love playing, but I wasn't really into the lifestyle, and I didn't see me traveling and living out of a suitcase and doing all these different things. And then there's all the weirdness just playing local gigs, much less schlepping around in a van all over the countryside. And
had you done that?
Not really, not much. I played commuter gigs. I mean, played San Antonio and all these towns around. But I didn't really do the prolonged thing at all. You know, just because the bands I was in played mostly local gigs. Mm-hmm. So and at the time, I didn't realize I was making pretty good money at the time compared to what some people were making that were playing around Austin at that time frame, which I don't know if it's changed much now.
Right. No, I think it's probably the same amount of money.
Yeah, not much different, I don't think.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just, it's one of those things where it was something I didn't think I was going to do, but it kind of hit me between the eyes, and I came to the realization, you know what? That's the best fit for you. No, that's a good thing to do, because I still gigged, so I could kind of do both. So I could have the store and still play out around town and be kind of flexible with my schedule a little bit too.
Because no drum shop existed, right?
In no. Austin.
Yeah.
No.
Was there any drum shop that you had been to that you had seen?
Oh, you know what? Not really. Not at that time. Kirk Scott was down in San Antonio, but I hadn't been to his store. And, I was aware of other stores around the country, obviously, but I'd never been to one. But working for two other music stores and knowing a lot about the equipment and how to play and everything, it was kind of a natural fit for me.
And you had been working there, you were doing, like the ordering and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I wasn't at that level with the stores. I was more just like a salesperson, you know what I mean? Because I really, that was more the managers, the floor managers and things that would do the sale, do the ordering and do the books and all that kind of stuff.
So you didn't know that end of it? Is that?
Not really. I mean, but one of the guys at Gerald Reed Music, Louis Krizak, he was kind of the manager, though, music department. He kind of took me under his wing, and so I kind of shadowed what he did, so I knew a lot about what he was doing. And at the time, actually, when I was working at Reed, I became real good friends with another guy by the name of Tobe Scott, who was their band instrument repairman. But he worked on brass and woodwind and string. He worked on everything. He was amazing. And at the time, I thought I was going to apprentice, and he was agreeable to it. I was going to apprentice and go into band instrument repair. But, you know, I was just more interested in the drums and percussion part of it. So even though I would have loved to have that knowledge, and I watched him at length, you know, working on horns and everything, to find out what he was doing and everything. So it was fascinating me, but I just really couldn't jump in with both feet with that.
Right.
So I decided to do my own store. It was on the heels of leaving JRE Music, and then here again just, you know, a few months later opening my own store.
So you told your boss, though. You said, like, this is what I'm going to go do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And what did he say?
Well, he was kind of going, wow, really? And, I mean, he was very supportive, but, I mean, he's thinking, oh, gosh, well, because he knew that was a lot. That's a lot to take on. I mean, yeah. You just, you know, anytime you open any business, I don't care if it's a music store or anything, I mean, it takes a lot. You got to really throw your life into it, and it changed my life up a lot of different ways. You know, just because of the longer hours and being open 6 days a week and taking care of everything that needed to be done, it really kind of narrowed what I was doing from I still play gigs and stuff like that, but I mean, kind of the free time I used to have, you know, just listening to stereo or hanging out or going out and seeing other bands, clubbing, that kind of thing. It kind of really kind of started restricting that, which I didn't really mind because I'd done my fair share of that already, but it really kind of just changed my focus because of what I had to, was obligated, I made myself obligated to do.
Right, right, right. But you were a young guy.
I was a young guy. Open store, I was 24. I know.
That's wild.
It is wild.
When you look at it now, right? That's wild.
It is. It is. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's some things are just hard to explain. But I worked a bunch of different types of jobs. I mean, I worked at the original Saxon Pub over there on 38th and Ave Street. I was one of their primary cooks over there. I did that. You know, started as a dishwasher and then became one of their main cooks over there at the Saxon. That was the original Saxon Pub. And watched a bunch of live acts there. Used to have all the Cosmic Cowboy people come in through there and saw, and, you know, watched Kenneth Redgill's band and Rusty Layton and John and B.W. Stevenson. I mean, a whole shopping list of all these performers that were playing at the Saxon Pub back then.
So you're meeting guys too during this time.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
And you're on the scene as a drummer.
Yeah, yep, yep.
You know, would you say you knew all the guys before you even opened the
show? No, not really. No, I mean, I knew a lot of them, yeah, but I wouldn't say I knew them all because, I mean, even back then there were people moving into town, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew a lot of the kind of established, some of the people and some of the established acts that really, to me, were the foundation of Austin music capital or whatever. I mean, these were the bands to me that just laid the groundwork for the reputation. I mean, I spent many, many nights at the Armadillo World headquarters and saw virtually anybody you can name over there.
Yeah, throw some names. I mean, when you say the original.
Well, so everybody saw ZZ Top and saw Tony Williams and saw Old and New Dreams and saw Freddie Hubbard and saw. That was a cool thing about Armadillo is that one night they would have a jazz act, the next night they would have, you know, Commander Cody, the next night they would have a ballet, the next night they would. There was no barriers with what Armadillo did, and that was a cool thing about them. And that whole scene was really, really cool. I mean, I saw Frank Zappa there every time he performed there. I was there at the Bongo Fury thing when he recorded that album, because Frank loved the Armadillo, and so I saw him every time he performed there. And he used to do two shows. So, and back then, if you can believe it, the tickets were something like $4. So I would walk out, see the first show with Frank, you know, you walk out and turn around, get back in line, walk back in, because I'd always go to the front of the stage. I was in standing room. It's kind of like an extra large mosh pit, if you want.
Right.
But, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of sitting in Armadillo. It was mostly standing. Yeah. So I'd be just right from, you know, just a few feet away, in front of the stage. I mean, you can almost reach out and touch the players, you know, that thing. I saw Freddie Hubbard, and I saw, you know, Roy Buchanan. I mean, just Trapeze, the original Trapeze, the original Journey with Ainsley Dunbar on drums. They were badass. They were so good. Just a straight-ahead, great rock band. Huge number of things. So I'd see jazz acts, I'd see rock acts. The only thing I'm kicking myself about is I really wasn't into country at the time. And I wish I, not that I wish I was into it, but, you know, Commander Cody and New Riders of the Purple Sage and Willie Nelson. I mean, this whole cavalcade of all these country stars, or soon to become country stars, everybody was filtering in and out of the Armadillo at that time.
I just didn't really care for it.
So I was being, sure, in fact, I'm kicking myself, but I went there so much anyway, it's kind of hard to say, well, you didn't do this.
Right.
But, you know, I remember one time a good friend of mine was living in an apartment complex, kind of catty corner where Armadillo Ward headquarters was, and My Vision Orchestra was playing that night. For some reason, I decided, no, I'm not going to go. But you could go out on this balcony, and, I mean, it wasn't maybe 150 yards, if even that, from where Armadillo. I mean, you could hear Mahu Vision Orchestra as if somebody had the stereo on really loud. I mean, it was coming through crystal clear. It's like listening to Mahu Vision Orchestra without seeing them, you know, live. But, I mean, they were, that was an amazing place, you know what I mean? And I think really built the whole legacy of the whole Austin thing, just from the people that were involved with it, and it was remarkable. It really was.
So, you got the idea for the store. I mean, right. You just start looking for spaces. I mean, you just start looking for.
Yeah, I was living in the downtown area already, and at that time, you remember going back that far. You know, there was. It was a totally different Austin than it is now. And I happened to cross to Enfield Center and noticed there was a space for lease, or actually a couple of three spaces for lease. And I struck a deal with the landlord, and he was kind of going, wow, okay, this guy wants to try this. Here I am, 24 years old.
This kid.
Yeah, right, yeah. You know. But he was a really cool guy. And I struck a deal with him, and to give me a break on, I think the rent was something like $250 a month. But I struck a deal with him. I said, I'll keep your parking lot clean. So I would go out there every Sunday with a long handled sweeper, and I'd literally clean up and sweep up the whole parking lot. And that would be kind of my compensation for him giving a break, let's say, on the rent.
So we cut down the rent doing that?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And so I lived in the basement below the store.
You lived there?
Yes. And unbeknownst to me, I found out the hard way that there's a lot of rain, Shoal Creek floods, and consequently, where I was living downstairs in the basement, floods too.
Uh-huh. Okay, so just to be clear, were you living at home? Is that what...
No, I was living beneath the store.
No, I meant before that.
No, I was living over on Nueces Street off 12th and Nueces, about, you know, six blocks away.
Okay, so when you get the store, you move in as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was there, you know. And,
sure.
And
then
when...
Paying one rent now.
Yeah, paying one rent, that's part of the deal, and, you know, obviously on a shoestring budget, and also I was, you know, I was there, so, I mean, even at night I'd go up and I'd arrange and organize things. I had it tweaked out really nice. It's a small area. It's only about, I don't even know if it's 800 square feet, maybe,
wow,
for the store. It was a small space, but I maximized the space and had a nice front glass window, and I'd do all these really, really good-looking displays that people just pass by and just go, wow, you know, because I had lights on it and all this kind of stuff. So it kind of created a little, nice little eye candy list.
You had a vision.
Well, yeah, sorts, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
I mean,
basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And so I made use of the space I had and lived downstairs, you know, and that's how that whole thing started.
So,
you know?
But how do you start as far as, you know, working with distributors or the companies? Like, how does that all work? Like,
well, I knew, that's here again, I'd met some of the reps for some of the wholesalers.
Okay.
And back then, there was only a handful of primary wholesalers really in the whole country. And I was friends with a couple of the key ones, and so I just reached out to them and let it be known, hey, you know, One of them actually came by and saw me and wrote up an order where I was living over on Nueces before I even moved into the store. Wrote up an order before I even moved over, you know. So I struck a deal, got, you know, started bringing stuff in from these wholesalers and started working on getting my inventory together. You know, I had a pretty good vision about what I wanted to do and what I wanted to have in the store. And so I was just systematically going about doing it. Some of the, you know, the brand names and things were more difficult getting because there's already pre-existing dealerships in Austin. And so when you're the newbie, you're the new kid on the block, right? You have to prove yourself. So you stay open and you do good and you get noticed or whatever. And then over time, slowly but surely, I'd start, you know, took me a while to become a Ludwig dealer. In other words, it took me a while to become really a lot of different manufacturers because they, you know, they either have, like I say, they have people already or stores already in place, you know, and they don't want to piss off the competitor, right?
Right.
But
right.
When it became obvious that I was there, I mean, Tama was a biggie for me. And
like as in early on?
Well, fairly early, yeah, because at that time, Tama was just hitting the scene. And so they were one of the newer brands, and they really made a huge splash with their hardware. Their drums are great, too, but I'm just saying the hardware was what everybody was talking about at that time. Well, nobody was really inventorying Tama hardware anywhere in Austin, and I jumped in with both feet, and I started selling, getting Tama hardware and then eventually Tama drums, and, you know, and so that, you know, that just, that really helped me tremendously.
Yeah.
So it just kind of happens slowly, progressively over time.
Yeah, it does sound a little bit much like a band starting out. And like you said, you can't get into this place. You got to prove yourself. You got to.
Right. It's like, no, you know, folks are going to, you know, hey, we'll go see you, give us a board tape, whatever.
Right.
It's like that you got to prove yourself. Otherwise, why are they going to go the time and trouble or expense, really, of opening somebody else out when they go, oh, wow, they'll be out of business next year, whatever, you know.
So what brands are you getting initially? Like, what do you...
Well, the wholesalers, I could get drum heads and I could get drumsticks. So I can get, you know, I can get the ProMark or the Regal Tip or Remo heads and that kind of things. And I was getting, could get LP hand percussion, a lot of, you know, stocked a lot of small LP hand percussion with the cowbells and the woodblocks, the go-go's and things. It's kind of a strange twist of fate. When I first opened, I didn't have any drum dealerships. So I put my sets on the floor on display because it's a drum shop, right?
Right.
So I put my sets on the floor and set them up. And people, hey, how much? I'm sorry, I can't sell you at that point. How about, well, no, I'm sorry, that's not for sale. So ironically enough, the first new set I brought in was actually a Fives kit. And that was at the tail end of when C.F. Martin owned Fives. So there's only two colors in one configuration available because they were down to the bitter end, unfortunately, with Fives of that era. So I brought in this five-piece 22, 12, 13, 16 black set. And that was literally the first new set I had on the floor.
And did that sell quick?
Yeah, I sold to one of my best friends. And then immediately wanted to change the color on the set after buying them, which I didn't realize it at the time, but the black covering was actually vertical formica. And man, was that a pain in the butt removing off those shells. Oh my God. I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in that, you know, just removing the old cover before I could recover. And so that was a big learning lesson on that one.
Oof.
Yeah, that was tough.
But you knew CF, is that, you said the...
CF Martin,
right.
The guitar company, they were the last owners of Fives.
Yeah, so where was that located at that point?
Nazareth, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, because we can jump around, it's okay. Like,
that's, to me, you know, going on the whole Fives tangents, that's another story beyond the drum shop, because the only common denominator is me, but I mean, as far as current Fives, but I mean, that happened years later, you know what I mean?
Okay.
But that was back in the back of my mind, because I really wanted, even at that time, I really wanted to build.
Right.
You know, I was really into it, you know. And
so you did want to do that. You thought that this was the next step?
Yeah, well, I didn't. It wasn't like I thought it was going to be the next step. It was just one of those deals where I knew in the back of my mind I'd really like to try that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but here again, when you're wrestling, when you're wrestling what you got, you don't really have time to really think about going off in another tangent.
Sure.
At that point in time, at least, you know.
Sure. And I'd imagine, I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, early on there were moments you thought, what the hell have I done? Did I bite off more? Or not? Were you just full of just...
Well, you know what? Not really. But the thing about it, I mean, you know, in the early days, I mean, if I had $100, I was dancing on the ceiling, you know? Just because, I mean, when you've got nothing, you ain't got nothing to lose, right? So when I would have any kind of day and we'd go, yeah, great, okay. And then the word kind of got out, and things started kind of just slowly, kind of the slow roll, you know. All of a sudden, I'm starting to get a little bit more traffic because the word's out on the street, let's say, and that kind of thing. And that's really, I mean, the word of mouth. I mean, it's not like I was advertising or anything, mm-hmm. you know. I printed up this 8x10 flyer that I passed out and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was a real grassroots kind of thing, you know. So, I mean, over time, you know, I'd say after about a year or whatever, I mean, I started having pretty decent flow of traffic, and it was, you know, it was cool. It was cool.
And like you said, the drummers were getting to know you. They're coming in.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, getting sticks and heads and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly.
Is it a little frustrating initially when they're saying, hey, can you get me, I mean, I'm making this, you know, like a Ludwig snare drum, and you're like, I can't.
Yeah, it was, but you know, the thing about it is everybody's being really kind of supported back then, you know. It's like, I think they understood what the circumstance was, because if they saw this at this music store, they saw this at the music store, I mean, they kind of got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
you knew then, just hang in, and it'll all happen.
Yeah, yeah, and slowly but surely, I mean, you know, started doing this with Slinglin. Well, Slinglin was kind of, they were on rough times. They were going to be on their way out, too, but...
you didn't know that at the time, right?
I knew something was going on with them, but I managed to get for one customer a Deegan, a Commander Vibe, full set, turned out a set of vibes for her, and which was a miracle in itself, because I mean, the whole Slinglin Deegan thing, it was on its last legs at that time, you know. So that's kind of why I was able to, so that way I got Slinglin. So I got a Slinglin set, and I sold a few of those, and Ludwig eventually came to Ludwig. Ludwig changed reps, who they were using. The prior rep wouldn't even give me the time of the day. Well, a new rep came in, and he came in the store and looked around. Says, he called right there. He was on the phone. He said, hey, man, I'm standing here, and he's got a whole wall full of drum heads. He's got all these sticks. He's doing this. He's doing that. We need to open up. And they said, okay. So I became a Ludwig dealer, you know. And so one by one, I was starting to get these dealerships.
Right.
You know, so kind of happened in earnest, you know.
That is a good, yeah. And then you get guys coming in, they need a kit. Hey, Ludwig.
Right in Pearl. So a new Pearl, too.
Pearl.
Yeah, and so, you know, and the Tama thing I mentioned, so...
One by one, we're like...
Yeah, it's kind of like dominoes, you know, because... companies, they see if another brand's in there, they're going, whoa, wait a minute. Let's give this a second look. And that's kind of what happened. You know, it's like, here again, if you stay open long enough and get established, then all of a sudden, you know, doors start to open for you on all these various brands that you were trying so hard and wouldn't get anywhere with, you know.
So would you say Slinglin was the first major brand you had as far as... Or was it Ludwig?
I got Slinglin before Ludwig. And that's just by the timing of that. But and Pearl I got fairly early on too, and Tama I had fairly early on. So
right.
So those, I say Tama and Pearl, and then Slinglin, and then Ludwig, of course, and the Fives that I was telling you about. But here again, they were on that was kind of the tail end of Fives of that era. But yeah, and then later I got Yamaha and Sonar and some of these other brands in too. You know?
Sure.
And one of the biggest promotional things that happened to me early on was did a Billy Kahn clinic and actually advertised on the radio and dropped some bucks on it. But we did his show. We did his clinic. It's more like a show, but did his clinic at the old Austin High Auditorium, which is now the ACC Auditorium. We had about 650 people or something like that in there from all those radio ads.
Did you charge entry?
That one was free, I think.
Okay.
Back in the day, and it changed over time, back in the day, you know, if you bought, because Billy's set at that time, double bass, floor mounted, two or three floors, set of octobons, shitload of cymbals. I mean, it's a massive set.
Yeah.
That's Billy Cobb.
Billy Cobb.
He hit everything.
Yeah.
And made it talk, you know.
Yeah, pre-Bozio. There was
Billy Cobb. Yeah. He was, well, you know, when he was a ground shaker at that time, when he hit the scene, it's like, holy crap.
I mean, before him, he had the biggest kit at that point.
I think so. I mean, unless you want to think about someone like a Keith Moon or something like that had the double bass thing. There were other drummers out there, Ginger Baker. There were other drummers out there that had the double bass, multi-tom things going on. But then when you get into kind of what, let's say the jazz fusion-ist kind of thing, with him at the scene and the double thing with the McLaughlin My Vision Orchestra. I mean, and just the sheer chops that he had. I mean, that was a huge splash. So,
how did you even get him? Did you know him?
Well, that was arranged through the company. That was arranged through the parent company of Tama.
Got it.
And that was part of the deal. That was 81, I think. It was 81.
But you have to arrange the, like you said, this other theater. You have to arrange.
Yeah, I do all the production. Yeah, I do the advertising, promotion, printing, you know.
Tommy's Drum Shop Presents.
Yeah, exactly. And what happened on that, and it was a lot different then than it is now because the economy was different. And what would happen is a lot of the companies, when I bring somebody in, they would co-op. In other words, they would either split the performance fee or pick up the hotel and airfare, or do these various things. So basically, for Billy, if I remember correctly, basically what I did is obligated and bought a huge amount of equipment from Tama. So I spent several thousands of dollars on Tama gear that Billy could play on.
Okay.
That was my commitment with them, you know.
I see.
That stuff doesn't really happen really anymore because the economy's different. The companies don't have the wherewithal to do that anymore, you know.
That makes sense, though. I get it now. So, yeah, you have it. You have to set it all up.
I do everything.
Yeah.
I do everything except the performance.
You're the tech.
I'm the tech. I'm the MC. I'm the, you know, I'm whatever you need to be. I'm the cartage guy. I'm taking back and forth to the hotel, go out for dinner afterwards. I'm doing it all, you know.
Right. You pick him up at the airport.
You run to the airport and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
But,
did he treat you good?
Oh, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
Great guy. We had Billy two or three times for a clinic. Billy's a sweet guy.
And then does that mean you get to sell the kit after the fact?
Yeah,
and say, this is Billy Cobb.
Oh, hell yeah. And that's some people are like, I got to have that. Right. But if I remember correctly, that set really got split basically in half because that was way beyond.
Sure.
You know, and I think the octobon sold separately. I mean, those may have gotten split in half, too. I mean, so everything got, you know, the cymbals. I mean, he had a gazillion different cymbals, zildjian cymbals up there at the time. And so all that stuff got kind of, but it sold, you know.
Yeah.
And I kind of knew that, you know, with somebody like that high profile, that I wasn't going to be sitting on it long.
Mm-mm.
And to bring somebody in. And that was a really big, promotional thing for the store because, like I said, took out a radio ad and which they ran in rotation, and boy, I didn't have any idea it was going to fill that. But I mean, 600, that's pretty amazing.
You saw the difference after that of the people.
Well, then I mean, that's got that out there, so mm-hmm. people are talking about the people, you know, because it wasn't just drummers coming. Same, I mean, people were coming there that could be just music enthusiasts, you
sure,
know,
sure.
All instruments or whatever, because they're seeing Billy Cobb, for God's sake.
Sure.
Know? And so, it from a promotional standpoint, it really helped a lot.
So, who were the early drummers in town that that sort of helped you? I guess is the best way. I mean, who kind of said, you know, I like you, and I'm going to come here, and I'm going to help.
John Traynor was around. If you, I don't know if you ever knew Mambo Johnny. He's a great guy. He's a good friend of mine, and incredible player. He's the one that comes to mind most, just because of he was one of the better players in town. Steve Metter, another great player. He's playing with a band called Passenger at the time. There was quite a few.
With Roscoe Beck.
Yes. Yeah. And Paul Ostermeyer, you know, and James Polk, and then became Bill Ginn. And they were doing fusion stuff. They were, I'd go see them at the Treehouse over here at Barton Springs over here. And they were just, I mean, they were throwing down. You know, Steve was just unbelievably great drummer. I mean, he kind of looked like Steve Gadd, you know, and he, behind this black set, and he's got the beard, and he looked like Steve Gadd. Played about, you know, sounded really right. That good.
Right.
So there were some really good drummers at the day, you know, and some other drummers weren't known as drum, but they were just in good bands, you know, Denim or Lavender Hill Express, which was Steve Framos, came from behind the drum set and then came forward, became leader of his own thing, but he was the original drummer of Lavender Hill Express, and there was a bunch of that going on because that was the whole here again. That was the whole thing about the outflow of the Armadillo and all the various bands that are filtering in and out of town and the local players feasted on. And so there were a lot of great players back then.
Yeah, of course. Oh, I get always, right?
That's, yeah.
That's one constant in this town, at least.
Yeah, and Tommy Taylor and I were friends from this high. You know, we used to rehearse our different bands at a church, you know. I mean, so we go way, way back, you know. And so there's just a lot of people that would filter in and out.
Yeah, and again, word of mouth. I mean, like you said.
Yeah, and that's really the way to do it, because I was starting to carry stuff that nobody else could find, nobody else had in town. And that was kind of the deal, because being a specialty thing, it's kind of like what I do now. You know, I've got a bunch of stuff, nobody else knows what it is or has the slightest idea, and I've got it, you know.
Right.
And so that's, to me, that's where kind of the specialty store kicks in, you know.
Yeah, just to back up for 1 minute, like when you were talking about this idea, were there people who were saying, like, you're crazy, like the idea of a niche kind of drum shop?
No,
did
not
anyone at all. Say that?
No.
Okay.
No. Not that I remember. I mean,
they didn't say it to your face.
They didn't say it to my face.
Right,
they
made
it say behind your back, boy, this guy's a nut.
No one told you, like,
but no,
bad
nobody,
idea.
My dad supported me 100%, you know.
Because, I just think that's amazing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I mean, he came over and helped me remodel the original store, for God's sakes, you know. He was into it, you know, because he's going, wow, because here I am, you know. He's wondering what I was going to do because I worked all these different odd jobs. And said, hey, I'm going to do this. And he knew I was serious, and he rolled up his sleeves and helped me, you know.
Yeah, no,
which was cool.
It's
you know?
An entrepreneurial bent. And, I mean, come on, again, how many 24-year-olds?
I know.
Again,
I know.
It's retrospect. You really see that.
Well, I do. But, you know, at the time, when you're in the middle of a storm, you don't.
No, you're right.
You don't think about that stuff. You know, you just do it. I just did it. I didn't question anything. You know,
yeah.
I just said, I'm going to do this. And I mean, it's 24/7 for me. That's what I mean. It changed my, I mean, I was totally focused outside. I was gigging on weekends, and well, actually during the week, so I had quite a bit of gigging going on too, but it was nothing that really interrupted the store. I had to, you know, change anything up, you know.
Right.
But that's why I did start closing. That's why I closed at 5 on Saturdays, because chances are I was playing on Saturday, so I'd close early on Saturday because I need to boogie and make it to the gig, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. But that's great. You have access to all the gear. I mean, not bad. As the drummer, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Need a new head. You need new sticks.
It's right, like, right.
Not bad.
Yeah. Well, I was never a breaker, so I mean, I wasn't breaking cymbals or heads or anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but it was cool to be able to walk in. I need these drumsticks right here. You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Fresh
and they're bought heads. And paid for by me.
Not bad. So wait a minute. How long? When did that location? How did the change happen? Like, when did
I went through 6 floods, including Memorial Day flood, and
damaged gear.
Oh yeah, and it completely submerged where I was living downstairs.
Yeah, you'd mentioned that, so I figured.
And that was a Memorial Day flood. That was the biggest, but I had everything from just coating the floor to 3 feet to this, all these different ones. But every time it happened, the stench and the silt and the filth, and you got to rinse everything out and clean it off. But on Memorial Day, it's creeping up the stairs, and we're busily lifting stuff up and getting it above water. It came up the stairs and went about, it was about a foot, 18 inches in the top floor where the store was. And I remember one funny story, my mother, the water was accumulating, so I think my dad said to my mother, somehow they made it there, somehow, I don't know, they took back roads to get there. She opened the front, got to open the front door, let this water out, so she opens the front door, oh, what's that? She reaches down and pulls, and they came in a box at that, to Paiste Sound Edge 2002 hi-hats, were floating out the front door. Yeah, and those expensive ass hi-hats, even back then, you know. But that's just, that shows the power of water, you know. And so it's trying to get everything above the water level, and that was a scene. So that happened. That was I think that was 81.
And just hold on, just 1 second. I just want to understand something. When you say your apartment basically below is submerged, and this happens numerous times to you.
Yeah.
Where you lived?
Yes.
Do you lose everything?
Well, you know, I lost a lot. The first time it flooded, which I didn't have any concept, I actually had an upright piano, fully restored upright piano down there. Mm. And the first flood was about 3 feet. I had my full record collection down there. I had this huge record collection. Bunch of books. I had a bunch of books and appliances and stuff like that. Well, all the stuff got trashed, just absolutely trashed. You know, a pair of JBL Studio Monitor speakers I had. You know, a bunch of different things, because I didn't realize at the time, oh, you're living in a flood zone.
But no one, he didn't tell you that.
No. And I don't really hold him accountable for it, because up until that point in time, I'm not sure if that really happened like that in Austin before at that time. But you can understand, that was how many years ago, and so was all the building up north in the corridor, what they're talking about, the runoff, the accumulated runoff, by the time it made it that far south, that presented that dynamic. In other words, I don't think he had any knowledge of it happening until it's too damn late, you know what I mean? So I hung in there for a little while, but there was another flood following the Memorial Day flood, and didn't quite make it all the way up to upstairs, but it pretty much almost completely submerged downstairs. And I just broke out in hives. I just said, I can't deal with this anymore.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So it was one of those things. I just said, you know what, I've got to move.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, when you lose all your LP collection and books, things like that, you replace, or do you say, like, fuck it, I'm not...
Well, you know, I mean, some of that stuff I couldn't replace. I mean, you know, I was a big Mothers fan. I had all the original Mothers albums. I had, you know, vast collection, you know, just a bunch of jazz stuff, a bunch of rock stuff, you know. And no, I didn't, because, you know, where am I going to put it? What am I going to do with it? Because I was going to, you know, have to move and up anchor, you know.
So
basically I wound up across the street from where I am now. There's an old dilapidated, it was a paint contractor that had this funky house, and then had this really large tin warehouse. I mean, it was basically wood framing and a large tin warehouse that they use for, you know, storing their supplies and stuff. So ended up getting that and moved in there, and then moved into that store. And the store where I lived was probably 10 by 10 feet. But there was a shower inside. And it was that small.
You know? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I lived
there. But you're young and you're working your ass off.
Yeah, exactly,
home, right?
You know, and
right.
Tried to make that. But it was really tiny, and it was a lot more constricting because it was an old dilapidated house. And I said, oh, man, you know, this isn't working. So we annexed off the big tin building and then built that building. It's across the street, the large building, as I call it. and moved in there in March of 85. And that's 6,000 square feet over there. So I went from tiny to large and laid out the floor plan with doing clinics and shows in mind, you know. And so we moved in there. Had a friend of mine, Todd with V2 Enterprises, and he built a stage. We put up lights. I got a PA system. I mean, we did full-on clinics there, you know. Right. Had Simon Phillips and Billy Kamamichin and Dennis Chambers and Steve Gadd and, I mean, on and on. Louis Belson, just on and on and on.
So without, you don't have to name names, but was anyone a pain in the ass? Was anyone?
Yes.
Okay.
But.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
But considering how many.
I would like you to name names, but I understand.
Well, I'll
if you
tell won't. You when the microphone's turned on. Because I don't want to disparage you.
I got you.
You know?
But
I mean, you know, to me, out of all the people and world-class players that I met, interact with, there's only two or three that I could honestly say I really don't care to be around.
Yeah.
Everybody else was great.
Yeah.
Was great. I mean, great to work for. You know, just a joy. You know, because and it's where I kind of developed this theory about players at that level is the chip of the shoulder is gone. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because it's proven who they are. Yeah. You don't have to prove anything to anybody. It's recorded. It's documented. It's the ones that really good players that haven't achieved that, some of them have a really bad ego problem. Because they know they're good, and others around them know they're good. They just haven't been with the right band to hit, right?
They feel they haven't gotten the recognition
and got just
they truly deserve.
Yes.
I'm with you, because I've been, I know.
And that
the Jim Keltners are really great. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
They're really nice guys.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it's Jim Keltner, for
Hal Blaine
sake.
Was a sweetheart.
Yeah,
exactly.
Hal Blaine was great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all those guys are really good. And
it's the lower level
guys. It's the next tier down, and they could play Swiss Triple with their big toes. I don't care. But it's like, well, you know, I'm good. Well, yeah, you are, but put your, you know, park your ego out the fucking door.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, come on, really?
It's a shame.
It's a shame.
But this is real. This is real.
It's the real deal.
Yeah.
But the most of the guys, with very few exceptions, were a very big pleasure to work with.
Right.
Because they're really nice. And, you know, typically we'd go out for dinner and we could just laugh and scratch and got all kinds of interesting stories. And, you know, it was a very personal kind of deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, helping them set up and then... unless they had really unusual requests, I would do the sound, because it's a real simple, it's typically just the drums only, so I'd just do a real Spartan kind of thing. But I mean, it worked, you know?
Yeah. Were there guys in town, drummers, that you knew come in that you'd be like, holy shit, it's so and so, like, you know, that kind of thing? Did that happen for you?
Not for the local players, no.
No.
Okay. No, because.
You knew them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, I always respect everybody. I don't, you know, somebody's beginning, they're beginning. I don't, you know, that's,
sure.
there's nothing, you know, but be flipped out by anyone? Not really.
It never happened to you where, how about an out-of-town guy, just a drummer, walked in and said, hey, this is a drum shop. And you thought,
really,
holy
not
shit,
really,
but, it's so-and-so.
Well, my second clinic was with Max Roach.
I mean, yeah.
You know, so when Billy Cobb, Max Roach, and then I've got it all written down. I started being and hanging. Max hung around for 3 or 4 days, and we were bopping around town. He had this cute little girl in his arm. We just bop around and hang out and have fun and tell me all kinds of interesting stories. And
the good stuff. He told
yeah,
you.
Yeah, the good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, a little sidebar. Max and I, Andy Summers with the police, invited us to the Synchronicity Tour, so we got comped into the Irwin Center. And so Max always dressed real dapper. He's fedora, double-breasted. He looked like he's right out of GQ, just in a perfect general. He's just, the way, his whole aura, the way he carried himself, everything was just friggin' amazing. And so, yeah, we go and saw the police show, and there's another story behind all that I'll tell you sometime. But anyway.
Well, what did Max think of the police show, by the way?
He dug it. Max was an open book to me. He was enjoying it. He was enjoying it, you know, and he dug it. And he and Andy apparently were friends from before, and I don't know how or when, but they were talking about doing some sort of project together. And so there was something there. And so Andy was a joy. He was a really sweet guy. And,
yeah.
You know, we went backstage and...
Well, because Andy's older than singing Stuart Copeland. He was like an older guy. He's like 10 years older than me.
Is he that much? I don't
something
know.
Something like that. Well, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He knows how to behave.
Exactly.
Yeah, other two, not uh-huh. so much.
Well, they were
and
young.
They just respected Max, in my opinion.
Stuart Copeland.
And Sting.
No, I'm just making...
Yeah, I know, which I think is incredibly ironic.
Did you know who he was?
I introduced him.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I think they had other things going on in their lives at the time.
Sure.
You know. And, I kind of laugh about that now because, I mean, obviously talented, incredibly talented guys, but, you know, how Sting professes to be a jazz and he said, this is fucking Max Roach. Mm. This is jazz right here. See this? Right here. I understand not for me because I was a peon, but this is Max Roach right here, you know, in living flesh. But Andy was a great guy. Andy was fantastic, you know. He was kind of the social butterfly, saying hello to everybody and just being a happy person.
Yeah.
The others were just kind of in their lair.
Young punks.
Well...
Yeah.
Anyway, it was interesting experience.
No, I know. It's not even an excuse because, again, you were 24 and opened it. I get it.
Yeah, I was a little bit older then. I was.
We won't even give him the age, in other words.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, but yeah. Anyway, that was just one of the many. But, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that happens, you know,
mm-hmm.
with various players. But he was a real thrill hanging with them, really. I mean... He was in. It's not like fly in, fly out. I'm gone, you know.
Right.
So I really got to kind of know him a little bit, and just a pleasure to be around. And most of the guys were. There's, like I say, there's very few exceptions to that. Very few.
Yeah.
About three on the top of my head that I was thinking, wow.
We could probably guess them exactly, like, because they probably have reputations.
Some you would probably be spot on. I don't know. But
there's always a surprise.
They're
okay.
All, yeah. But,
yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. You know, that's cool, too, because
sure.
I don't... Everybody's in their different thing, but I mean, but fortunately, most of them were really, really pleasure to deal with. I mean, you know...
I get it.
You know, Simon Phillips, he was a perfectionist, you know, so we had to go get... we had a wooden stage, but he wanted plywood... down two sheets of plywood that he actually planted his bass drums on. He was very specific about how he wanted his setup.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because it has to be plywood. You know, it's funny.
Well, it is because we're on a wooden stage anyway. But anyway, so some of these people had very specific things they wanted. You know, and which was fine because they were nice people. He was a very fun guy. I mean, very enjoyable, very professional to work with. And I got a funny picture of us hanging out at Chewy's after the show. We got hammered. But anyway, he was a sweet guy. But, I mean, most of them are, you know.
Yeah.
Fortunately, you know.
Yeah. Well, drummers tend to be.
I think there's kind of a brotherhood. I know that's kind of probably oversaid sometimes. But, you know, I don't know. If you get a bunch of drummers in a room, by and large, they're kind of... You know, they're kind of engaging to one another. I'm not sure that would happen with guitar players or other instruments. I don't know. I mean, maybe it does, but that, you know, I just think with the whole clinic thing that kind of really happened with the whole drum clinic thing, you know.
Yeah.
You didn't see that happening really with the other instruments at all.
No, I mean, it's like that old thing of stereotypes exist. I don't want to get into that as an umbrella statement. I'll keep it to just drummers and guitar.
Yeah.
Stereotypes exist for a reason.
Right, exactly.
There is truth in that.
Yeah.
I mean, guitar players are guitar players.
I'm not going to show you my lick.
Hey, I need guitar players too, you know? Like, I like them, you know?
Yeah,
but,
I mean, you know, you gotta.
But drummers really, there is this brotherhood.
There is. By and large, there is.
There are exceptions
to the rule, but I mean, by and large, it is kind of a brotherhood, you know? And that's the cool thing about it.
Yeah, like you pick, at least you pick that, in other words. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah.
You could have been a guitar shop or, you know.
Yeah, right. Which is cool. I mean, you know, I've got good friends that are, you know.
Some of my best friends are guitar players.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's no big deal, you know. But that's just the way it played out. So we had just a bunch of different clinics.
Right.
Over the years, just a huge amount. But it was, it's getting more increasingly over time because just because of the pure numbers of producing a show like that, and now, you know, when it, in the later days, you know, the artists wanted more money, and the companies weren't at a place where they could actually co-op and help participate. So it's getting more and more expensive. And I mean, my whole deal was is I didn't want to charge too much for tickets because people, you know, I forgot what I charged for Steve Gadd, but it may have been $6 or $8. I don't even remember. I mean, I've got it written down somewhere probably, but I felt guilty if I charged too much money because people look at you and go, well, wow, it must be, they don't understand. You know, oh, it must be making a killing off of this. No, actually, on most clinics, I took a bath. I mean, really, quite literally, on most clinics, I took a financial bath on it. You know, but, you know, it was something I wanted to do. And
yeah,
that everybody came out in droves and was digging on it, you know.
Right.
And I liked throwing the show. You know, I'd go up there being the MC, and we'd do, you know, door prizes and do all this wild and crazy stuff up there, you know. It was fun.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. Believe me. I know. I know about, yes.
It's throwing the show.
You have to have the passion for it.
Yeah.
And a real love.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not for the money.
Well, yeah, exactly.
There's other things to do.
There's other...
Right? Am I right? I
mean, and hopefully over time, without all that goodwill I was spreading, that people would go, oh, man, well, this is a place to go.
Well, right.
And you know, I think over time, I think that that bore itself out. You know, it's not...
Sure.
It's just you can't monetize it right then and said, oh, yeah, oh, my God, the next day after clinic, I mean, cha-ching, cha-ching. It doesn't happen that way, you know. It's just, here again, the word of mouth, and all of a sudden you see new faces. I'm constantly seeing here now new people because there's so many people moving to the city now.
My hands raised.
Yeah.
I know. I get it.
I mean, every day, almost, really, we see new people.
New drummers. Which, hey, I'm new.
Yeah,
hey,
yeah. Right, I just moved right in. Hey, what's the scene like? Where can I go to? Where's the jam night? Da, da, da,
right,
da, da.
Right.
Which I let all my guys tell them because they're much more adept at that. I feel like I'm so out of the loop now because I don't go out on the scene. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just, I don't want to deal with traffic and chaos and...
Oh, I get it. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Enough's enough. I mean...
Well, I've done my time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
But, wait, so just to be... We got to touch on the Fives thing, though. How did that happen? Like, you... How did you... I know.
That's a long story into itself. Okay, well... Okay, basically... Oh, what's the best way to tell this? I've been snooping around some industry friends, and I kind of let it be known that I was... I tried to buy Camco, the Camco name. I tried to buy Gretsch and put that out there, and I was in negotiation with them about that. And those are all kind of sub-stories within itself. So anyway, a good industry friend of mine, who... This guy was brilliant, but he... He called me out of the blue one day. He said, you need to call Ken Austin. Darwin's for sale. Well, Darwin bought out from Quarter. Quarter bought out from Martin. So it went from Fives to Quarter. So when C.F. Martin sold the company, the Fives brand and mark was sold to another individual because there was still a license with Martin for drumsticks and accessories with the Fives mark. Okay, so basically Fives got separated from the factory, fixtures, machinery, tooling, and so forth. So all the factory went to Huntsville, Alabama. It became Quarter Drums. That lasted for about 10 years. They had a moderate amount of success, I guess. And then the Quarter family sold to Sammy Darwin, who is a radio programmer, and he moved it to Burnsville, Mississippi. And he had it for about 2 years, and it was obvious he didn't have the slightest idea what he was doing. Fortunately, he had a good product floor manager, John Cummings, who worked for Ludwig for quite a few years, and so he kind of became his chief guy over there, So I was put on to Ken Austin, say you need to call, because Ken was working with Sammy, and Sammy said, help me sell this drum. Help me sell this. I need to get out from under this, because they were kind of floundering. So anyway, so I contacted John, and we met in Memphis, drove down to Burnsville, and toured the factory, showed me all the machinery around, and met with Sammy. He was asking a lot more than I was willing to give on it, but he just wanted to wash his hands the whole deal. So while I was negotiating with that, and when that deal was going down, I was kind of simultaneously negotiating with the owner of the Fives trademark, another individual altogether.
Oof.
And yeah, which when I first contacted him, he said, you're fishing, aren't you? Aren't you just fishing? That kind of thing. It's like, and then so I started telling him, well, this is what I'm doing. I'm buying this and I'm doing this. He's going, oh, okay. So anyway, and the freaky thing about it is the sale of Darwin. And I had it in my mind because Ken Austin, and he just said, well, we can call it this, we can call it that, we can call this new drum company. That said, no, so that's bullshit. You say, everybody knows what this is.
You want it Fives. It's
got to be Fives or it's not right. It's just not right.
Is that what they did with Corder, essentially?
Well, Corder was a family name.
Right.
Jim Corder and his family.
But was it the shells and the hardware?
Well, no, they changed everything up because they weren't doing the fiberglass anymore.
Right.
And so they were doing wood shells, and they dabbled in marching percussion. They did some hardware stuff and everything. But, you know, but they had all the tooling and fixture machinery and everything. So, no, but they kind of taken a different direction with their old product line. And so anyway, I was negotiating with this other guy to buy the Fives trademark, but the sale on Darwin went down before the Fives sale went down. I was sweating bullets because I was convinced it's got to be this or it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so sure enough, he came through, did the deal. So I reunited him and rebirthed the company. So I moved everything down in December of 94. 7 days or 5 or 7 days of the hardest work I've ever done. I mean, we were assholes and elbows just in filth and things. Loaded 2 18-wheeler trucks up of all this stuff. I mean, just intense work. Just getting everything cleaned up, put up. The stuff can be thrown away. The stuff can be recycled. The stuff needs to make the move. The stuff needs to be broken down. I mean, you name it, everything. I mean, we just work like dogs down there. And so they drove the back roads so they wouldn't get weighed. And that's literally the truth. Because they were loaded to the gills. I mean, they were overweight. And cool truck drivers for both those. And they helped out, too, because they saw, man, these guys are shit. They're working like Trojans over here, you know.
Right.
So anyway, so that happened, actually closed the doors on December 7th, about 4 o'clock in the morning. Which I thought, how ironic, that's Pearl Harbor Day, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, so I was thinking, well, there's some irony in there somewhere. And I don't know what that, you know, I'm not trying to read anything to anything, you know.
A day that will live in infamy.
A day that will...
I believe it's called. You like that
yeah.
one.
Yeah, so anyway, but that's literally the date. So yeah. That was, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, whatever, and we're just like, you know, just jelly. So anyway, they head off, making the way down to Austin. We regroup, take a shower, head back to Austin too. And that's kind of the short story on that, even mm-hmm. though it didn't sound too short.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so basically from there was setting up the factory, which was over here on Lamar over here, where that Google and the other thing is now. They did a total remodel of the building, so you don't really recognize it much. But we set up over there, and then they actually went to the trade show, the NAMM show, that January, right after the acquisition. We didn't have any product, we didn't have anything, so I had this idea of, we got a big oak table, and we got these captain's chairs, these little, you know, and they had the Fives logo on the back of a different color. So here we are, this big captain table, and we're all sitting in our chairs with no product. And everybody's coming by, we're going, yeah, we're open, we're da-da-da-da-da. And people just freaked the fuck out on that one. which was, looking back, was comical. You know,
it's like a bit.
It was kind of, we created a faux pas because here they are, you know, putting all this time and energy and money and thing in advertising and for something that doesn't exist yet. So, taking orders?
I mean,
no, we couldn't at that point in time because we didn't have everything wasn't in place. We didn't have all the product lineup in yet. So, but by the summer show, the NAMM summer show, is when we showed the first Fives set that we made, which is, I still have, actually, I still have that original set. It's boxed up, but I mean,
this is fiberglass.
No, wood. It's okay. Made, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One thing, fiberglass we did was shell snare drums.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because all the molds, all the old fiberglass molds and everything used back in the day at the original Fives, they are on such disrepair, everything, they were not.
Oh, no, I'm going to get shot by the listeners, like, because I admit I do not know my Fives history, like, perfect. I don't. So that, let's make that clear.
Yeah.
I do not.
Oh, but that, yeah, no, but yeah, why would you? I mean, you know, it's one of those things, unless you're off in the middle of it, you know, you... Like, it doesn't matter whatever company it is, you know, unless you want to get up and start peeling the layers of the onion back, you kind of find out what's going on.
Oh, I know. So, I've played them. They're amazing. I mean...
Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
This was an unsolicited... Not yet.
In cash, please.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. This was my wallet. Here.
Exactly.
So anyway, so that's when we actually exhibited in Nashville at what they call it at that time, the summer show. With the first kit that we had, and we had a handful of snare drums too,
right?
And so that's what started, and then we went to what 20 straight trade shows, winter and summer,
right?
Exhibiting.
Now, is this a major pain in the ass to run like that? A drum company, is this like?
Let me put it this way: manufacturing makes retail look like a walk in the park.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, I'm glad I did it, and if I can stay healthy and alive long enough, I'm going to go back into production. That's my goal, because I really want to do it. And I've got a lot of rabid people out there that hoping that I will. And that's my goal.
Really?
Yes.
You really do want to do it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely. I've got the space to do it and got all the machinery in the building and just got to get it set up and do all that kind of stuff.
Shit.
Yeah. It's a formidable deal.
But do you have time for that? I mean,
well, that's kind of the problem right now. I'm kind of in the catch-22 because this is my asset here
right.
in the store. That's my liability over there.
Right.
Right? So right. That's kind of, you know, the yin-yang of the deal right now at this moment.
Yeah.
But it's amazing to me. Well, you know what amazed me first was how much pre-existing Five stuff was around the world. I had no concept.
And yes.
And then what we built... And from basically 95 till about 07, which was a time frame that we were in production and built a bunch of stuff. So there's Fives all over the world, right? And all the, you know, all the generation stuff. And there's little quarter stuff out there. There's a little bit of Darwin stuff out there also, of course. So my first goal right now, my plan of attack is basically... going through and inventorying all the parts, seeing what I've got plenty of, see what I need to make, see what I need to order, see what needs to be chrome plated, what needs all these various parts and everything. I want to get it all cataloged because I've got pages and pages of people that need parts. So I want to be able to service these people for the parts they need to keep their drums original, right? And so that's my goal. That's job one for me. So that's what I'm working on now, is getting all the parts and getting it all organized, everything, so I can fill all these orders. Well, systematically, once I have all the parts in place, everything, then the next step would be being able to go in production because I would have all the component parts to make the drum set on hand.
Wow. All made in Austin, Texas?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, are you looking for investors?
I've had that offered to me, and I'm not really comfortable with it because I...
they wouldn't be silent.
And I don't want to... Yeah. And I don't really necessarily close the door on the right person I felt comfortable with. I might, but I have a very strong opinion. I know what needs to be done and how it needs to be done.
Yeah.
And if somebody puts a lot of eggs in your basket, they want to have a say on what they want you to
That's
do.
That's what I'm
too.
Saying, yeah.
Yeah, and which I understand that because they've got an investment in that, but, you know, I've been there and done that. You know, this isn't my first rodeo. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it's one of those things where I know what I want to do, I know how to do it, and I know how it needs to be done.
But have there been names who've approached you, like, about?
Nobody that I can talk about, but
right.
nobody that well.
You have to say
yeah, okay. yeah. I mean, kind of partially. Others are just people that
just fans.
Yeah, fans, and they have money.
Just diehards.
Who yeah, really yeah, and they're right. into it. You know, right. they're just into it, which
right.
Great. You know, that's fantastic. You know,
they're collectors, maybe.
Yeah, they're collectors, or they're enthusiasts, mm-hmm, or. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They just like the whole concept of being a part of that, you know,
yes, yes.
that type of thing, and yeah. which is great, you know. But I'd be, you know, and the whole thing with partnerships is what falls in the partnership thing. Everything is great when you're in a partnership and everybody agrees. When you don't agree, that's when partnerships get really ugly.
Oh,
yeah, you know that. And so it's one of those things where I don't want to get in that scenario just because I don't feel like I'll have to get in that scenario. And now here again, I don't totally close up. Somebody came along, I was really, really, thought really got it and was behind what needs to be done. I might consider it. Like I say, I don't close the door on anything like that. It's just outwardly, I don't see it working because it's just...
I don't need every day.
Well, I don't need somebody, right? you know.
So talking. Tell me, what are we doing? What are we doing?
Yeah, Tommy, yeah. Well, what about this? Have you thought about this? No, 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 no. Well, actually, I think about a lot of things all the time. You know, just, you know what I mean?
Yes.
So it, you know, it's just one of those deals.
Well, what about the flip side? Have you had guys come to you and say, I would like to buy it off you? Have you
yes.
had that?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I've had that happen, uh-huh. too.
Is there a number? That,
yeah.
That would you would
not right now. There isn't.
Interesting.
No. Right.
But the guys have, and they've
yeah,
had,
yeah. Lowball offers. You
oh,
know?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. They've thrown out a number. And
yeah,
it's like,
yeah, exactly.
Get real.
No.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I mean, you know, I guess it never hurts to ask, but I mean, nothing I would seriously consider. No.
Right.
You know, because now, as it stands, I mean. Fives was established in 65, for God's sakes, the original Fives. Well, there's that whole legacy
wow.
and goodwill for that many years.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Going back to Billy Cobham, right? And
yeah.
and Alan Dawson and Grady Tate and all these great players that played the original Fives. They're big friends with Bob Grasso. And and John Marina, who was his partner in the original Fives. So, you know, there's all that history or legacy of all that, you know, that's, to me, it's cumulative, you know, that I stacked on top of what was all pre-existing, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, to me, the offers that I was given don't take into account for what's history has shown, you know. Because I don't consider Fives a boutique brand, you know. I think it's a major brand, you know. This isn't some sort of startup deal. I mean, we got a full wood shop, full machine shop, spray booth. I mean, we make some of the own parts in house. I mean, we do. I mean, this is a real deal factory, you know. And so, there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, interesting, man. Yeah. I mean, it's good to hear that you.
Yeah,
this is still on the.
I'm just trying to stay. Knocking on your microphone there and
yeah.
stay healthy and
yeah.
and everything else like that. And
sure.
And if I can, I'm going to pull it off.
I love it. I love that attitude.
No, that's my goal. I mean, you know, I wish I could spend more time over there now. I'm trying to get everything in place over here so I can spend more time over there, that kind of thing. You know?
Right.
But that's a complicated thing because, here again, this is my asset, you know. This is...
the sure thing.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, I think the Fives would be a sure thing, but to get everything in place is an investment of time and money.
It takes time to get it going.
Yeah, time and money to get it operational.
Right.
And that's a lot. That's a lot to put into.
And then you're dealing with distributors and blah, 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 right? And
well, the vendors, yeah, the different vendors.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah.
And that's part of getting the parts thing together, is reestablishing or finding new alternative vendors and things like that to reestablish with.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Got to deal with Steve Maxwell.
Steve Maxwell. Yeah. I've never met Steve Maxwell.
I'm joking.
Yeah, well, he did something on Fives. I saw him and his son. Somebody hit me to it, and I looked at it, and part of it was correct.
You know, I bet.
Part of it, and you know, but I mean, he didn't bother calling me and saying, "Hey, what about this? What about that?" You know, it's
well,
like,
he's just a guy who hasn't. You know, I mean,
well, you know, it is what it is. Yeah. You know, I'm not. I was saying sure. Disparaging about that, but
no.
You know, it's like if people don't know. Sometimes they just make stuff up.
Interesting.
Yeah, now, I'm not.
That's
saying
interesting.
I'm not saying him specifically, but that happened. You know,
You've heard it all.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
guys,
you know,
saying
people,
this
well,
is what happened.
Well,
and this
yeah,
is what,
exactly.
Right,
oh
right.
Gosh. Yeah. I mean, I mean.
Right.
Somebody said this goes back X number of years that he was in the room when I sold Fives to DW, and he was in the room when I did it. Yeah.
That's shit you can't.
Yeah, you know, my wife and I were getting a divorce. Right. That's why, you know, there were all these lines coming in, and when I ceased production, all the shit started coming out, and people are doing all this, making this stuff up,
yeah,
because they don't know. Oh, right. They're this. Oh, with this. Oh, they're doing that.
I was in the room.
Oh,
no.
Somebody told me that.
Brilliant.
And I'm thinking, God, what a crock of.
But what was the final, like the shell? Like, what is it? What's the layers? What are we talking about? Like,
well, there's three different thicknesses.
Yeah, tell us.
Yeah, six
that.
Ply is the thinnest on the toms, floor toms. Then we did eight ply on the snare drums for structural rigidity, and then we have a six ply on the bass drum. But the individual plies are thicker, so it goes thin, thicker, then thickest.
Okay.
Yeah, on that.
Okay, so...
And that's all stuff we formulated and got together with, John and I, my plant manager, and we arrived upon that, and that was part of the trick, is kind of reestablishing the Fives thing, you know, was, you know, because Corder had kind of taken it in a little bit different direction, you know, Darwin had kind of taken it a little bit different direction, and I was adamant, said, we need to come back to square one here, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Everything short of doing toms and floor toms and bass drums and fiberglass. But that would be a huge investment for molds. And quite honestly, I don't know if the market would even be worthwhile doing that. Now, the snare drums are a different thing altogether. And I've got those molds and everything, and that's part of what we do for fiberglass snare drums.
Because people love those.
And they sound friggin' ridiculous.
Yeah.
And so, anyway.
And hard to get.
Yes, they are, you know. And so that's part of that whole dynamic of, oh gosh, you can't get to, oh my God, wait, then, you know, da da da. So it kind of creates that whole groundswell of craziness there, too, you know.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny, you know, people want to get what they can't, you know, really lust after what they can't get. You know, there's this, we used to have a big dealer in, Canada, in one of his techniques, he's a drum manager up there. He had Fives set up. They sold quite a bit for us, and people, oh God, how much is that drum set? Look at this beautiful Fives kit. They go, you can't afford it. What? He would basically insult them and tell them, no, you can't afford that. No, you don't want that. And he would play that game with them and just kind of just play on their psyche. And he's a past master of doing that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's got their own technique, right? Yeah. So that was kind of...
Don't even look at it.
Yeah, don't touch it. Don't touch
it. It's out of your league.
Yeah, it's got the little tagger on it. It's never been played. Yeah, that kind of thing, you know, from
totally,
Spinal Tap.
Totally,
yeah. But, yeah, so anyway, but that's part of the buzz. And, you know, it's kind of go, well, where were you when we were in production? Because part of the deal with the whole thing is... It's the bigger the beast you build, the more you have to feed it. Shit, I had stuff set up. I had stuff set up where we could have produced, I don't know how many sets them up, but a huge amount. I mean, we could have produced just a large number. Thing about it is you're the new company, you're the new kid on the block, as it were, trying to establish, you're going against the Ludwigs and the Pearls and the Tamas and the Yamahas
right.
and the Gretsch and everybody, Sonar,
right.
everybody else.
Right.
And you're fighting for market share.
Right,
yeah.
But at least it's within the American-made stuff.
Yes.
You could subcategory, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I don't know enough about it. Like, I know Rogers came back. I don't know enough about all
right,
that,
right,
you know,
yeah,
to comment. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm glad. I mean, I had the opportunity. I had that offered up to me by Rogers X number of years ago.
Right. Right.
But
You said you looked into Gretsch, you looked into
Kamco, but by the time I was kind of solicited about Rogers, I was already in the middle of getting Fives going.
Right.
And so that's the last thing I wanted to do, but it was offered up to me. The last thing I want to do, I'm going to take on another drum line? No.
No.
Then you have to deal with that whole bag of everything that that was, you know?
Right, right.
And so...
it's a whole thing, man. I know.
It's a lot.
It's a whole thing. Like you said, it sounds like you could do a whole podcast just on that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 So...
a six-part series, an hour each.
Yeah, it'd be like a mini-series.
The Roots of Five.
Yeah, that's right. That's
all
right,
let's do it.
That's right, yeah. So anyway, so that was going on, and I was still doing the store, and I was toggling back and forth between it, but I had a whole crew. I had my plant manager, John, there. It's really talented people in there doing the various and sundry work, and just turned out really, really high quality, nice instruments.
Yeah.
You know.
All right. Well, I mean, I hope this, you know.
Well, there you go.
I like it.
There you go.
You've got the right attitude.
Well,
so.
You know, well, I'm as long as I'm not taking a dirt nap, I'm here, you know.
You look good to me, man.
Well.
Tommy, I appreciate you giving me your time. I know. I get it. It's late. Thank you.
Oh, are we done?
We can wrap it up. Unless you would you like to drop a little something? I mean, Tommy's Drum Shop.
Yeah.
1100 South 8th Street, Austin, Texas.
That's correct.
You have an online.
Not much of an online presence, more just kind of like a dump website. So
right. Okay.
Call the store. Yeah, don't even get on Facebook. People evolve. Don't even go Facebook. Call the store. That's why I have a phone number.
Call Tommy. You heard this? Call him up. Tell him you heard this. And,
yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And so, and tell him you were laughing your off. You know.
Exactly. And ask him about who the pricks were. And ask
him more about.
Well, how Sting was, that rat bastard.
Oh, my God.
I believe it.
Oh, my God. Well,
it's Stuart Copeland I'm ashamed of, but whatever.
Well, you know what?
Him, I'll say he was a kid, but Sting gets no...
Well, I know. Well, I just think it's one of those things. They were in a different place at a different time.
I get it. You know, I get it. I know.
Stuff going on.
Stuff going up, going
stuff,
on.
Yeah,
I get
stuff
it.
Going on. And that's,
I get it.
You know what?
I get
the
it.
The show was killer.
Of course.
I mean, they just... threw down. It was a great show, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know. But, so anyway, that's that.
I understand. I get it, man. Thank you, Tommy, for doing this. I really appreciate you taking
your
time.
Glad to do it.
Right on, brother.
All right.